All right. Well, this is part four of four. And like I said, some of you have requested the extended edition slides, the director's cut. That'll take a little bit longer to go through. I did quite the amount of trimming this week to get us into a doable section of Scripture. Well, not Scripture, but a doable section of history. So what I want to focus on now is modern times first. So from 1967 and kind of get us up to current day. And to really illustrate this idea that the two-state solution that we keep hearing about on the news is an imaginative fiction. It's naive at best. That's the best way we could describe it. And it's just, you know, grossly irresponsible on the other end, and negligent to not understand the times, as it were. So if you remember where we left off was right after the Six-Day War in 1967. And remember, up to this point, what we've covered is that, number one, the Jews have always had a presence in the land, even though it waned to very small numbers at times in the 15th and 16th century. There's always been a Jewish presence in the land. Number two, there's never been a Palestinian state or a desire for a Palestinian state up to this point in the history that we've studied. And that if there were an opportunity for that, it has been outwardly rejected by the Palestinians. And you're going to see more and more of that in our section today. So after the 1967 war, remember, this is where we were before. This was the West Bank. Okay, I'm ringing a little bit. This was the West Bank, and it was controlled by Jordan. Okay, this was Jordan. This was Gaza down here. Gaza was controlled by Egypt. Okay, Israel was this regular colored area right through here. After the 1967 war, remember, 6 days, grossly outnumbered against all odds, Israel now has possession of Gaza, the entire Sinai Peninsula, and the West Bank, and the Golan Heights up in Syria. Okay, all in the course of 6 days. Six providential, miraculous days, I would argue. Okay? So when this war is over, remember, the idea from the Israelis was, we've got land now to negotiate. We will give land back in exchange for peace. And if you remember, the last thing we talked about last week was the Arab League met after the 1967 war and gave out the no's, right? You know, no negotiations with Israel, no recognition of Israel, right? They don't have an interest in that. So they have all this land and they think they can negotiate, but that's not what the Arab nations are interested in. So we bring in the UN. All right, and UN Resolution 242 is the one that keeps coming up because that's the resolution that was passed in regards to this situation. Okay, it was supposed to be a peace agreement, but it's become the source of all the controversy. Okay, and this is what the resolution called for. One, a termination of all claims or states of belligerency. So we want to stop fighting. Okay. And then number two, recognition of the right of every state in the area to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries free from threats or acts of force. So we're trying to define boundaries in this resolution. And it also calls for this, and here's the phrase, withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. Well, if we just read that on its surface, it sounds like the resolution is saying Israel's got to go back to their to start. Right back to the 1948 or 1960 pre-1967 borders. It's really the most disputed phrase in the resolution because that's what the Arab states say. The Arab states say, hey, clearly that says you guys have to go back to your previous boundaries. Now, remember, we talked about last week the reason why Israel is hesitant to go back to those boundaries is they cannot protect themselves if they go back to those boundaries. Right. They are a sitting duck if that happens. Right. But here's a little bit of research, which most news agencies don't do anymore, is if you do a little research on this, the framers of this resolution, an American ambassador and a British ambassador made it very clear that that's not what they were saying in this resolution. So I want to show you this. They left out words like all territories or the territories because they wanted to keep it vague because if you look at our U.S. ambassador at the time, Arthur Goldberg, said the notable omissions, which were not accidental, in regard to withdrawal are the words "the" or "all" and the June 5th, 1967 territory lines. The resolution speaks of withdrawal from occupied territories without defining the extent of withdrawal. It doesn't say Israel has to go back to 1948 borders. Okay? And then even stronger is our British ambassador. He says it would have been wrong to demand that Israel return to its positions of June 4th, 1967 because those positions were undesirable and artificial. So the two guys that wrote the resolution said that's not what we mean. They wrote it in there to make sure that people weren't saying you have to go back to 1948. Yeah.
Why did Israel have to concede if they won the war?
Well, the idea is we want to do some sort of negotiation in order to try to broker a peace. Right. I mean, that's the United Nations. Right. We'll all just get along. That's the idea. And so Israel's willing to give back some land. They're just not willing to give back all the land because, again, it puts them in a state where they can't defend themselves. Right. So this is part of that negotiation. And you'll see how the Arab nations usually react to the negotiations. Yeah. Sure. Well, they're not. That's basically going to be it. Yeah. Is the Palestinians are going to make demands and Israel's going to say we can't do that. You know, and you'll see it flesh out here. So just check it out there. But they know if they give back 100% of the land, they won't survive. The truth is, what you have to understand is that Israel's one war away from genocide. They're one war away from elimination. And that's the perpetual state that the state of Israel lives in. And it's not, oh, we'll survive. No, if we go back to those borders, we will not survive. Okay, that's the mindset. Let's see. Oh, went too far. So as part of what the Palestinians would call occupation, okay, which I think is a bit of a misnomer, by the way. But as Bonnie said, they won the war. These are legitimately taken lands, right? You attacked us, you know, now deal with it. But Israel, here's where some of the controversy and the stuff you're hearing about even today is that Israel developed settlements with Israeli citizens in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Now, they're not in Gaza anymore, and I'll talk a little bit more about Gaza when we get more to modern times. It's more in the West Bank today. So when you're hearing about Israeli settlements, it's in the West Bank, which, again, the Palestinians say that's occupied territory. That's our land. Israel's saying, no, actually, it's our land. You know, we've conquered it, rightful spoils of war. And it becomes the flashpoint of the dispute. And as they expand in the 70s and 80s, and as you know now, Netanyahu continues to build, which the international community just can't handle. They really don't like that. And so the final result of the Six-Day War, really important, is the rise of Palestinian terrorism. Right? The PLO comes out of the Six-Day War. And if you guys that have been around a little bit longer and lived through the 1980s know all about the PLO, even the 1990s. The operatives became the innovators of terrorist methods. And these are the guys that did the airplane hijackings in the 70s. These are the guys that were blowing up school buses with children on them. These are the guys that, I'll show you the next one, the guys that attacked the Olympians in 1972 in Munich. Okay. They're hijacking planes. They're taking hostages. They would murder children and invalids. Like I said, when they would sneak into Israeli areas, they usually attack children's quarters first. It's intimidation. It's you will bow to our force. And like I said, the pinnacle of the terrorism is that 1972 Munich Olympics attack where they kill 11 Israeli Olympians in Munich. Okay. And here's our centerpiece of all this. Some of you may remember Yasser Arafat. Hey, he becomes chairman of the PLO in 1967. He's an avowed terrorist. There is no disputing that. He was absolutely a terrorist. He's the first person to address the United Nations with a revolver on his hip. Okay, yeah, how about that? And he's the mastermind behind all this. He oversees the airline terrorism of the 70s. He gave the order to kill American diplomats. He arranged terrorist attacks against Israel, including the attack in Munich. and killing 20 Israeli school children in 1974. And of course, later on, in dealing with America, he disavows terrorism. And I'll show you a little example of that. But at the same time, when he's back in Palestinian territory, he's calling for jihad the whole time. So he goes and he tells our naive Western leaders how he's never going to be a terrorist again and how he wants peace. And then he goes back to the villages, back in his Arab villages, and talks about how he wants to kill Jews and Americans. And I call that the two Arafats, right? You've got the happy Western Arafat that talks to Ivy League universities and writes opinion pieces in the New York Times. And then you've got the Arafat that talks back in his homeland about making martyrs and making blood run in the streets of Jerusalem. Okay? And I'll show you an example of that. He wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times called The Palestinian View of Peace. And in that piece, he condemned terrorism and he claimed that Palestinians are ready to end the conflict. And 1 week earlier, he was in the village of Ramallah, which is in the West Bank, and said, "We will make the lives of the infidels hell," calling for jihad, 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 and a million martyrs marching on Jerusalem. He's just playing people. And we're too stupid to recognize that. Okay, and if you think that is gone, I mean, we talked about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad last week, the former president of Iran, who's a Holocaust denier, who was given a place to speak at Columbia University, right? Was given a place to speak at the United Nations, right? And the Western powers just let him talk and spread lies and play everybody. But Arafat was the first one to start pulling that off. So then we get to 1973, okay, 6 years after the Six-Day War. Remember, after the Six-Day War, Israel felt pretty invincible. You know, they were pretty high and feeling like they couldn't be touched after all that. Well, on Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement, it is the holiest day on the Jewish calendar. And where everybody was celebrating, it's the most solemn and sacred day, Egypt and Syria launch a coordinated surprise attack against Israel. Syria in the north, Egypt in the south. And guess what? Nobody's on duty that day. I mean, it's the bare bones defense that's on duty that day on Yom Kippur because everybody is celebrating, right? And the skeleton forces there are overwhelmed in the Golan Heights by Syria and in the Sinai Desert by Egypt. And wait till you see the numbers. 180 Israeli tanks faced 1,400 Syrian tanks in the Golan Heights. 500 Israeli soldiers with 3 tanks faced 600,000 Egyptian soldiers with 2,000 tanks and 550 aircraft in the Sinai. Doesn't sound like a fair fight, does it? Okay? And within the first few days of fighting, Israeli forces are driven out of the Golan Heights, which they had taken in the Six-Day War. Remember, because Golan Heights was where the Syrians were bombing Israeli farmers in the Galilee. They had secured that. They're driven out of the Golan Heights. And in the south, the Israeli troops retreated from the Suez into the Sinai because of the two attacks. So, and all the while, the Soviets are supplying Egypt and Syria with weapons and aircraft and everything else. So Israel appeals to the United States for assistance. So this is 1973. So who's the president in 1973? Not yet. Richard M. Nixon was still president in 1973. He resigns in 1974. So they go to Nixon and ask for assistance. Okay? And within a week, the U.S. begins a massive airlift of weaponry to Israel. And this, along with mobilization of the IDF, checked the Arab onslaught and ultimately turned the tide of the war. Okay? And in the Sinai, we get a guy that comes on the scene named Ariel Sharon. He was a general at that time. He's a future prime minister of Israel. He engineers a surprise attack. He crosses the Suez Canal. He surrounds the Egyptian Third Army. And the IDF could march all the way to Cairo if they want to. A masterful move and takes the Sinai back. And in the north, at great cost, the Israelis retook the Golan Heights and actually were in striking distance of Damascus. So it's not quite the degree of lightning flash like the Six-Day War was, but still they recover and get the land and even more than they had at the beginning of this whole thing. But they lost 2,688 people in the Yom Kippur War, 350% more than the Six-Day War. And Israeli invincibility was shattered. They realized maybe we're not so invincible. We've got to be on guard all the time. You know, we've always got to be on. Okay? And the Arabs unleashed the oil embargo after this, which was a political move. Okay? Why? Because nations around the world need oil. And so what they're saying is, well, if you want our oil, well, you're going to favor us and you're not going to favor Israel. Okay? So you want to talk about why nations start to kind of lean the other direction. It's not, okay, who's better? It's we need the oil. Right? And that's why we're, you know, I think I mentioned it before, but Israel's the only nation in the Middle East that doesn't have oil. You know, and we're fighting over that little piece of land. They found some natural gas up toward the Golan Heights recently, I heard, that a great supply of it that could, you know, take some of that Arab oil out of here. But we'll see. Then we get to 1982. We get the Lebanon War. Okay, and this war is provoked by the PLO because they keep bombing northern Israel. See, the PLO and Yasser Arafat got kicked out of Jordan by King Hussein. And so they resettled in Lebanon and they started bombing northern Israel from Lebanon. Okay? And Arafat basically takes over the entire country of Jordan, I mean of Lebanon. And when the PLO assassinated an Israeli ambassador, the prime minister at the time, Menachem Begin, authorized his defense minister, who was Ariel Sharon, the general that made the big move in the Yom Kippur War, to launch Operation Peace for the Galilee on June 4th, 1982. And when they first got there, the Lebanese Christians and the Lebanese Muslims welcomed the Israeli armies as victors, as vindicators, as liberators, because Arafat's a terrorist. Okay? They don't like him. Okay? But here's what happened, and this is common even up to today, is the PLO terrorists would fire on Israeli troops, would shoot mortar fire and all that, and then they would retreat into civilian areas. And who gets the criticism? But the IDF gets criticized because they're moving into civilian areas. Okay? And you name it, Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, whatever the organization is, they're famous for firing rockets from hospitals and schools. Right? Because you can't, you know, it's hard to retaliate. And even so, when the Israelis would retaliate in these civilian areas, they usually give warning shots. They tell you, hey, we're about to bomb your city. You might want to leave right now. What other nation does that? You know, they tell you we're going to bomb this house in 5 minutes. So you better get out of here before we bomb it. Okay? They'll do the same thing when they bulldoze homes in Arafat's in Ramallah. They'll tell them, you know, you need to leave because this is what we're going to come in and do. You got 24 hours. You know, no other nation does that. And yet they're the ones that get criticized more than anything else. But basically what ends up happening is the IDF is able to secure a ceasefire. Arafat and the PLO get kicked out of Lebanon. Okay? And now they're kind of a freelance terrorist organization. So now we get to 1987, and like I said, what I'm really skipping in the slides is a lot of individual events. There's a lot of bombings, a lot of different things that go on. Like I said, if you want the slides, just get in touch with me. I'll send them to you, and you can look at them. But December 6, 1987, an Israeli shopper in Gaza is stabbed to death by a Palestinian. And the next day, an Israeli truck driver in Gaza loses control of his vehicle, and he kills 4 Palestinians in a car, right? And what's the narrative? That was retaliation for the first day, and now Israel wants to kill Palestinians, so we need to respond to that. Okay, so the Intifada, an Intifada is a uprising. There's been several Intifadas. There was one several years back that was a knife Intifada, where they said, go in and stab Israeli citizens. You know, those kinds of things. And rumors raised that Israelis had killed Palestinians deliberately, and this is the first Palestinian Intifada. So the Intifada included teenagers. They recruit children. Okay? Any idea why they do that? Because nobody doesn't like children. It's a sympathetic picture, right? And so they would get the kids to go out in the front, and they're the ones that are throwing stones and burning tires and throwing these gasoline bombs at the Israeli troops. They used hand grenades, guns, explosives. And so what were the images that came out of the fighting? Well, it was stuff like this, right? It was bully Israeli soldiers picking on the children of Palestine, right? When really it's totally a manipulation of the situation that's going on. Okay? The teenagers are not the ones fighting this war. They're the ones that are put out in front by the Palestinians. Okay? And that's the stuff that comes out in the news. And Israeli soldiers frequently commented that they would spend hours under assault by Palestinians without responding, but the TV cameras would only roll when they responded because their troops were in danger. Right? That's, you know, you think about media and selective truth, you know. Alternate facts, if you will, that kind of thing. Okay. And so as we move forward, I know I'm moving kind of quickly, but I'm just trying to hit the high points so you can see what's going on. And here's where business will kind of pick up a little bit. The Oslo Peace Accords are in September of 1993. And then soon after that, President Clinton is going to try to broker a peace between Israel and Palestine. Okay, that is Yasser Arafat on the right, head of the PLO. That is Yitzhak Rabin, the prime minister of Israel at the time. And they are ready to negotiate. Okay, and here's what Rabin said. I enter negotiations with Chairman Arafat, the leader of the PLO, the representative of the Palestinian people, with the purpose to have coexistence between our two entities, Israel as a Jewish state and Palestinian state entity next to us living in peace. So that's the Israeli prime minister, right? The Israel that doesn't want peace by the narrative that we hear. The Israeli prime minister says, my goal in these negotiations is to create a two-state solution with a Jewish state and a Palestinian state that live side by side. Okay? That's his goal in 1993. Okay? And he said, enough of blood and tears, enough. And so the Oslo Peace Accord provided for Palestinian autonomy on the West Bank and Gaza and set in motion a new plan for peace and security in Israel. And despite the ups and downs of the peace process, everybody thought, hey, maybe finally peace will come. Like there was some optimism for the first time ever in the region, and they had set a deadline for May 4th, 1999. Well, soon after that, Rabin is assassinated, okay, by a Jewish man that doesn't want the settlement to happen. Okay, and that upsets the entire peace process. So in 1999, I just want you to see what happened here. In 1999, Israel had relinquished administration of 40% of the West Bank. 40% of the West Bank was given Palestinian authority. They rule themselves in 40% of the West Bank. Cities, villages, they have control. They have the police forces. The IDF doesn't go in there. Okay? Everybody following that? And in Gaza, it's totally handed over. Okay? And it starts in about 1995. By 2005, Israel's going to pull out of Gaza altogether. And guess what happens in 2006? Hamas takes over and it becomes a terrorist haven. Okay? But security was a cooperative effort between the IDF and Palestinian Preventive Security Police. But Israel was reluctant to proceed much further because all the stuff that they set out in the Oslo Accords will give you peace if you'll do these things. The Palestine wasn't observing that. So, for example, I think I've got it on my next slide that I was thinking about. But by September 2000, the Palestinian Authority had 40% of the West Bank and ruled over 98% of Palestinians. 98% of Palestinians were being ruled by Palestinians. Okay? In exchange, Israel received nothing except a promise of peace. That's it. They didn't get any land. They didn't get any money. There was no settlement. That was the idea. And so that brings us up to the Camp David 2 meetings in 2000. Of course, the first ones were in 1979. But in 2000, Camp David 2. And we get the newly elected Israeli prime minister, Ehud Barak, and President Clinton. They meet with PLO leader Yasser Arafat once again to talk peace in 2000. Okay? And Barak was at the point where he was saying, we can't fight anymore. Okay, this is killing us. Yeah, Patty, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Well, they actually handed over not the entire West Bank, but portions of the West Bank, 40% of it. They said, you know, that village is yours, that village is yours, that village is yours. We won't come in. It's yours. You can run it the way you see fit. It's still technically Israeli land, but they are given total autonomy in small pockets within the West Bank. Yeah. Yeah, you're running ahead. You'll see exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Olivia, did you have something else? They basically said, we want everything finished by this date. It was, okay, here's what we're going to do, and we can't do it overnight. So they set a deadline, and eventually a deadline is going to come and go. Because the Palestinians have not met all the conditions. It is. And, you know, I'm not sure what the rationale is behind the number. But, yeah, it was not formal, but there's terrorism going on. Yeah. So with U.S. interests in the Middle East, Clinton also wants peace. And on top of that, if you remember, the whole Monica Lewinsky thing had just come down. And he was looking to redefine his legacy before he got out of office. Hey, this is the summer of 2000, so, you know, the election's coming in November, where George W. Bush will be elected. So he's trying to have the last thing people remember about him not be Monica. So I think that motivates Bill to get in there and try to do this. And it seems that Arafat wants peace. At least that's what he's putting off, right? Exactly. Okay, so at Camp David 2, this is July of 2000. It was supposed to be 14 days. It went even longer. And there's no official, you know, transcript of what went on, but the participants have all come out and said exactly what went on during that whole thing. And dramatically and quite unexpectedly, Barak concedes much of his original position. I mean, you want to talk about a one-sided negotiation. Okay, Israel comes a mile to the middle in this negotiation, and I want to show you what happens here. Barak agrees to recognize a Palestinian state within the Gaza Strip and almost 95% of the West Bank. 95% of the West Bank, which is almost 1948 borders. Okay? That's almost back to, I mean, you can't give much more than that. And that's the position and the ironic thing is Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated for less than that. So you talk about Barak stepping out on a limb to do this. He does it knowing he's going to get resistance from people in Israel. Okay? They were going to give up Jewish settlements that were in those territories. We will pull all the settlements out. You can have 95% of the West Bank, and we'll pull all Israeli settlements that are there out, which by the narrative today is the big problem. Okay? That's why people are angry, because of the settlements. He offered to pull them all out. Okay? And they allowed for up to 100,000 Palestinian refugees to return to Israel proper for family reunification. So if there were Palestinians that had family that were still in Israel, those people could return to be with those family members. Okay? They were going to give land back in the West Bank to Palestinians that had lost land over the years. Okay? So, and they were going to share sovereignty in Jerusalem. You can't come much further than what that offer is. Right? If we all went in and made that negotiation, we're not very good negotiators. That's how much they gave up. Okay? Here's what Arafat said. Israel's going to allow all Palestinian refugees the right to return, not just to the new Palestinian state, but to Israel proper, which would make Israel cease to be a Jewish state at that point. It would change the entire demographics of everything. Israel, we're going to withdraw completely to the 1967 borders. They're going to transfer sovereignty of the old city of Jerusalem to the Palestinians. So we're not sharing sovereignty there. We want the city for ourselves. And he even tried to convince President Clinton that there was no historical Jewish link to Jerusalem, which is a narrative that persists today. You know, they try to rip everything Jewish out. I think I mentioned this at some other point. They're expanding, or they have in years past, they've expanded the Al-Aqsa Mosque underneath the Temple Mount. And in doing so, they pulled out a bunch of fill dirt from underneath the Temple Mount, which is horrible in a lot of different ways. First of all, there's no more rich archaeological land than the dirt that's under the Temple Mount, right? And second of all, they actually compromised the structure integrity on the south end of the wall on the Temple Mount, and it was starting to bow out, because they removed some of the fill dirt. And so Israel stepped in and said, no, we got to fix that, because, you know, could you imagine the narrative in the media if the wall collapsed by the mosque? You know, how quick would it be that Israel destroyed the mosque and we have to do all this? But they basically just took all that dirt and they dumped it in the Kidron Valley. And so there are Israeli universities that are doing sifting programs and stuff. You can, like, request to be part of a team, and you can go sift this dirt. And they found coins from Hezekiah and Josiah and different things like that. So in trying to destroy the Jewish heritage, they've actually revealed even more Jewish heritage in Jerusalem. So, you know, God's kind of cool like that. Okay. And Barak can't agree to that. Okay? He can't. Yeah, there's no way he can give up all that. It's impossible to agree to the return of nearly 4 million Palestinian refugees to Israel proper. Their return would cause a demographic shift. Israel would cease to be a Jewish state. Israelis would never tolerate Arab control of the Jewish holy sites, because last time they had them, between 48 and 67, they desecrated as many of them as they possibly could. They said, oh, we'll take care of it for you, and then they'd vandalize them. That's what was going on, and that wouldn't happen. So here's what you need to understand about this negotiation. The Palestinians were offered the entire Gaza Strip, 95% of the West Bank, all Israeli settlements to be taken away, and shared sovereignty in the city of Jerusalem. And Yasser Arafat said no. Okay? So this narrative of, you know, the Israelis won't negotiate and they don't want peace, this is what was offered, and the Palestinian chairman refused the offer. Because if he had accepted it, they probably would have killed him. Because they don't want two states. That's the point. Okay? They don't want two states. They're not going to recognize Israel. They have no interest in recognizing Israel. You know, the whole thing is, yeah, two states would be ideal. And we would all agree with that. Two states would be ideal. But one side does not want to recognize the existence of the other state. They're not going to tolerate the existence of the other state. So if there are two states, all of a sudden that there's going to be one state. Okay? So that's why Israel has to hold on like they do to the policy that they have, or otherwise they don't exist. Okay? We get to 2000 and we have some violence on the Temple Mount, because Ariel Sharon, who was the prime minister at the time, he's the first Israeli prime minister to visit the Temple Mount. And now we know the Temple Mount is in Muslim hands. Dome of the Rock, Al-Aqsa Mosque. He visits the Temple Mount and he walks around. Pretty offensive, right? He walks around the Temple Mount, which you and I could do anytime we want to, because we're not Jewish. Okay? We can walk on the Temple Mount anytime we want to. Now, you can't take your Bible up there. They will take it from you. And don't hold hands with your wife either, because they'll yell at you. We had a couple in our group, you know, got accosted by a guy, because you do that at home. You don't need to do that stuff in public. Yeah, I'm not kidding. And so he visits the Temple Mount, and this sounds familiar, right, with the narrative, the spontaneous violence. Okay, they may think of Libya and Benghazi, spontaneous violence, as if there was spontaneous violence in a situation like this. Because as soon as he does that, the next day, and so what's the narrative? Well, he visited the Temple Mount, he was disrespectful, and now we're revolting. Well, he didn't enter any mosque. He didn't enter the dome. He never tried to. After a one-hour walk, he departs and goes back home. Okay? There was nothing done. He walked around the Temple Mount. Okay? And within 4 hours of the visit, Yasser Arafat was on the radio saying that the visit was a serious step against Muslim holy places, demanded that Palestinians move immediately to stop these aggressions and Israeli practices against holy Jerusalem. Okay? So he walks around the Temple Mount, and this is the narrative that goes out to the Arab world. Yeah.
But if everything's so hot about that moment, why would he walk?
Yeah, you can question the motivation behind all that. But what he did probably didn't prompt, you know, a terror war, which is what's going to come, a four-year war from it. Yeah, but I think you could address the common sense of, you know, people are going to be upset by it. Yeah. And most Israelis still won't even try to go up there, because they know it causes problems. Okay, other Palestinian broadcasts accuse Sharon of defiling the mosques and Israel of desiring to take over the Muslim holy places. I think we're jumping to conclusions here. And the next day during Friday prayers, the Mufti of Jerusalem called for a jihad to eliminate the Jews from Palestine. You know, because they want peace, right? That's what they want. Okay, Palestinian violence. There was mortar fire near Jerusalem. There were bombs in Jewish neighborhoods. There were snipers on highways shooting people as they drove down Israeli highways. Shootings in Israeli neighborhoods. There were suicide bombings. And I've got several listed there. They were at nightclubs. They were at different places. And one during a Passover celebration where they blew up a hotel. A suicide bomber walked into a hotel ballroom and killed 28 people. One of the people that died in that blast was a Holocaust survivor. And so that kind of stuff was going on. So now there's a bunch of ceasefires. And this is almost comical when we start looking at these ceasefires. So it collapsed immediately with more Palestinian attacks against Israeli police. Barak said that Israel was taking a time out from the peace process And Arafat said that there would be a Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital, and if Barack didn't like it, he'd go to hell. But they want peace. Okay. November 2000, three bombs exploded in 3 weeks during November, killing six. Okay, November 28th, Barack announced that he would resign. And then by February 6th, we've got Ariel Sharon that comes in. So the slides kind of got flipped around here. Okay. Then we got George Mitchell, United States guy, right? He did the steroid report too for baseball. So there was a Mitchell report with that too. But it contains 15 suggestions for peace. Right? And in the next 20 days after this peace proposal is proposed, there were over 300 attacks by Palestinian terrorists, including the June 1st bombing of the Dolphinarium nightclub that killed 21 teens. And despite all these attacks, Israel does not respond. Okay, terror attacks going on everywhere. There's another ceasefire June 12, 2001, announced by George Tenet, who was the CIA director at the time. Went into effect at 3 p.m. on June 13th. Within hours, Palestinian gunmen shot and killed an Israeli woman near an Israeli settlement. Later that day, Palestinians fired mortars on an Israeli post in the Gaza Strip. And so every time a ceasefire happens, more terrorist attacks happen. Okay. December 16th, 2001, Arafat comes out and calls for a ceasefire himself, Mr. Magnanimous Yasser Arafat, and we're going to get some peace. Well, a few weeks after that, they take a ship that's coming into the ports there, and it had 50 tons of weapons, including plastic explosives, anti-tank missiles, and rockets. So Arafat is saying, we want a ceasefire, we want peace, we don't want to fight anymore. Meanwhile, we've got ships coming in with that on it. Okay? So you see how he's just talking out of both sides of his mouth all the time. It's the two Arafats over and over and over again. Okay, President Bush says after a bombing that kills some children on a school bus, he says it's time for the two-state solution. So I want you to see how many foreign leaders are always saying, time for two states, time for two states, time for two states. He's the first U.S. president to say that, okay, to push for that. But what Bush says is you can have two states if Palestinian Authority will adopt a democratic constitution, hold elections for their leaders, and establish leadership that doesn't have terrorists in it. If you will disavow terror, then you can have a state. Well, that seems like a reasonable request, right? They don't want that. Right? All you have to do is promise you won't have any more terrorists in your government, and we'll let you have a second state. They don't want that. Okay? And the Palestinians reject the offer, just like Arafat rejected 95% of the West Bank. And then Bush comes up with this idea of the roadmap to peace, and that's supposed to be the next step that moves forward from both sides. Okay? Another ceasefire happens after that. Israelis are killed in terror attacks on nearly a daily basis during the ceasefire. Two bus attacks in Jerusalem kill 40 people, including children, wounded 236 others. And by September 6, 2003, the roadmap is pretty much in ruins because the Palestinians will not stop bombing buses and whatnot and things like that. Okay, so why are they fighting? And we're on the home stretch here. Why are they fighting? Well, one of the theories is, at least from the media, is it's the Israeli occupation. That's why Palestine acts the way they do. That's why they attack Israel over and over and over again, because the terror would stop, that should be if only the Israelis would end the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. If they just get out of our lands, we'd stop attacking. Okay? Well, let's examine why that doesn't hold up. Okay? In July 2000, that's exactly what Ehud Barak was trying to do. And he gave them 95% of their land back, and they rejected that. So it's not about the land. Okay? It's not about the occupation. Arafat refused that proposal outright. If the occupation was the cause of the violence, it could have ended with Arafat accepting that proposal. Could have been over. Okay. And by the way, there were thousands of Palestinian attacks between 1948 and 67, which was prior to any Israeli occupation. They didn't start when the occupation happened. They started when Israel became a state. Okay. In 1952, there were about 3,000 incidents of cross-border violence, and there was no occupation at that point. From 50 to 55, 503 Israelis were killed by Arab terrorists infiltrating from Jordan, 358 were killed in terrorist attacks from Egypt, and 61 were killed in attacks from Syria and Lebanon, all predating the occupation. Okay. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the formation of the PLO both predate the occupation, so the PLO was there before the occupation happened. The terrorist organization in response was there before the occupation. Okay? In 1947, when the UN partitioned Palestine into a Jewish state and a Palestinian one, which is another forgotten thing, they had two states at the beginning. Okay? The Arabs rejected the plan. Okay? And instead, Jordan annexed the West Bank and Egypt took the Gaza Strip. Well, I thought you were a Palestinian nation. I thought you wanted a Palestinian state. Well, how come Egypt and Jordan were in charge? Because there was no Palestinian state. They were lands that were controlled by other nations. That's all it was. Yeah, Callie. Not as much anymore, but they're not real friendly. But they were back then. Right. Yeah. There are several different ethnicities that have occupied the land at different times under other nations. So they're certainly Arabs, they're certainly Muslims, right? But the idea of a Palestinian is a kind of a modern creation because they were all from other places, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, everywhere else. Yeah.
Yeah. They
have
today and put the there.
Yeah. It's very interesting that, you know, in all the talk of refugees, wherever you fall on that, that these Arab nations do not accept refugees. They do not. Okay. So, I know it's a whole separate conversation, but they don't accept it, you know, and we're an ocean away and plus a whole continent away. Right. Callie. Well, when in the original land idea, the West Bank was part of Jordan. And so the Palestinians are saying that's our state. But originally that land was Jordan's land. Well, there's such an anti-Israel sentiment everywhere that that's what they can agree on, you know. Well, I mean, like, for example, I mentioned earlier, the PLO got kicked out of Jordan, right? Like, they don't even like the Palestinians. Okay? Marx and I were talking last week about that idea. Okay? The other Arabs don't even like the Palestinians. Okay? But it promotes an anti-Israel narrative, so they're not going to speak out against that. Yeah, it'd be interesting if it all came down, because I think there would be just another land grab, you know. Yeah, Ty. Egypt is the only nation that recognizes them. They're not exactly best friends, but at least they recognize them. After Camp David, they've recognized them. And Jordan's, for the most part, they get along pretty well at this point. They're not pro-Israel, but at least they're not Syria and other places. Yeah. Yeah. So the point being, they could have easily created a Palestinian state at that time, but they refused. They could have had a Palestinian state in 1947. They didn't want it. They could have had a Palestinian state later on. They couldn't. They didn't want it. They could have had it in 2000. They didn't want it. Okay? That's not the goal. The end goal is not that. And at that time, and now as well, the objection was not an occupied West Bank and Gaza, but the very existence of a Jewish state. That's the problem. It's not you're in our land. It's you're here. And you never should have been here, and you have no right to be here. That's why they're trying to wipe out the history. That's why they're trying to say there's no Jewish links in Jerusalem, because then they can paint them as occupiers. And you see what's going on there? It's all in how they're painting the truth. Okay? Yeah. So these groups reject Israel completely. They do not seek a Palestinian state next to Israel, but a nation in place of Israel. That's the end state here. Okay? And another flawed theory is the Israeli settlements. Okay? That's the problem. Well, since 1967, Israel has built approximately 150 communities, and this is a little older information, so it's more than that now, with about 200,000 Israeli citizens. Palestinians claim the settlements are illegal and have therefore caused the violence. The Palestinian objection to the settlements is based on the assumption that Israeli settlements are foreign elements in the West Bank. Right? That's the narrative. You guys are trying to create an apartheid state for Palestinians over here. That's what's going on. But if it's Israeli land, which it is, then it's not illegal. Okay? That the territory was never part of a Palestinian state. How can you invade a state that doesn't exist? Right? In fact, Jewish settlements always existed in those areas, with ancient Jewish population centers driven out by Jordan and Egypt when the 1948 War for Independence happened. There were Jews there that got driven out. How come they don't get a right to return? Because there will never be a time when an Arab nation welcomes Jews in. Okay? There are 25% of Israel is Arab. 0% of Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia is Jewish. Okay? Remember that. And the willingness to dismantle the settlements has been offered by Israel numerous times and refused numerous times by Palestinian leadership. Okay? And so the terror war of 2000 to 2005 ends at a summit. It's negotiated by Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas, who was the president of Palestine. He is now as well the Palestinian Authority. And the understanding was that both groups would move ahead with the roadmap for peace. Well, we're 12 years later, and the roadmap for peace has not brought us to peace yet. Because the terrorist attacks continue. They have not stopped. And so what you're asking Israel to do is to sacrifice themselves in the name of peace or maybe political correctness. That's what's being asked to be done. Okay? And this will be the last thing we cover, and then I'll wrap it up. But Israel's built a separation wall. How about that for some timing for us, right? They have built a separation wall, which is basically the 1948 to 1967 borders. Okay? And it began in 2002, and the goal was to prevent terrorists from walking into Israel and blowing people up. That's why they built it. Okay? Because that's what was happening. People were walking in and shooting up neighborhoods and blowing themselves up in crowded places and school buses and everything else. And so they built a wall to keep people out. And the wall basically, again, follows the boundary that existed from 48 to 67. And the Palestinians say, you're creating a border, and we haven't negotiated that border yet. But the fact is, it has greatly decreased terrorism. Okay? And I want to show you some statistics. In 2002, there were 60 suicide terror attacks. 2,307 Israelis were wounded, and there were 220 murders. Okay? By the time we get to 2004, and the wall's not even completely built in those 2 years, it's just partially built, it goes down to 17 suicide terror attacks and 595 wounded, and from 220 murders to 57 murders. And it's not even complete yet. Okay? It works. You know? And here's a quote from a terrorist. He says the separation fence is an obstacle to the resistance, and if it were not there, the situation would be entirely different. We'd be killing a lot more people if that wall wasn't there. Okay? They've admitted that. Okay? And look at the graph. Look at the death toll in 2002, and look what's happened since. Okay? It works. That's why the wall is there. It's not to create an artificial border. It's not to oppress people. It's to stop people from blowing up innocent civilians. And it's worked wonderfully in that whole thing. Yeah. So the periods of fighting have continued on and off to this day. Palestinians often commit terrorist acts, and the IDF responds, and they're often vilified for it. That's the narrative that comes across in the media. And the calls for the two-state solution have been sounded since before Israel's inception, and yet here we are, no closer to a two-state solution. Because again, that's not what the Palestinians want. It's not what the Arab world wants. Okay? And a two-state solution, again, it's an imaginative fiction. It's not a realistic goal in the way that it is. Now, if the Palestinians would say, hey, we'll stop terrorist attacks, we'll never do that again, we'll be democratic societies or something along those lines. Well, you could have two states, but that's not going to happen because they don't want to exist beside Israel. They want Israel gone. Okay? And I'll show you some quotes here. So we've got, you know, our leaders and European leaders that say things like, we continue to believe that a two-state solution is the only way for the long-term security of Israel. Okay, which is quite ironic because it's not. If it wants to stay both a Jewish state and a democratic state, which is exactly what John Kerry said in that speech with the United Nations. Angela Merkel in Germany says, we're saying this to both countries. We want a two-state solution. We want a Jewish state of Israel alongside an independent Palestinian state. Unilateral measures are not helping at all to bring about this cause, and we agree that we wish to cooperate very closely on this because, as we both say, time is of the essence. We have to do this. We have to just do it. And it just shows in, you know, just an abject ignorance of the situation. You know, and it's sad that people can't do just a little bit of research and see what's going on here. Maybe it's blindness. Maybe it's hard-heartedness. I don't know. Maybe it's a reprobate mind. I don't know what it is, but the facts are not paid attention to. Because look at this. Okay? Mahmoud Abbas, who's the Palestinian president, says, from here, from this place, our nation and our masses are walking toward the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. Well, Israel's not giving up Jerusalem. It's the holy city. It's the eternal capital of Israel. Okay? Well, we're not negotiating unless we get Jerusalem. Well, then we're not negotiating, right? That's not negotiation. And they've offered shared sovereignty in Jerusalem, and they rejected it. Okay? And we get to the more radical elements. Okay? We will never recognize the usurper Zionist government and will continue our jihad-like movement until the liberation of Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem being in Jewish hands needs liberated in their minds. Okay? Our resistance will continue as far as there is Israel. We will continue until we see the Dome of the Rock, Jaffa, or Yafo and Haifa. Okay, now if you know your geography, I'm going to help you out here. Jaffa or Yafo or Joppa in our New Testament is right there with Tel Aviv. Do you see it's on the coast? Haifa is way up here on the coast. So what that guy said is, we're not going to stop until we see Jaffa and Haifa. That's not Jerusalem. That's not two states. That's we're going to push Israel into the sea. Okay? We're not going to stop until we get to the coast. Okay? That's the mindset. Okay? And Naftali Bennett, who's an Israeli politician, and he's the one that's going to sum it up, and we'll end here. He says, I want the world to understand that a Palestinian state means no Israeli state. That's the equation. Okay? As Ariel Sharon said, if the Palestinians laid down their weapons, there would be no more war in the Holy Land. If Israel laid down their weapons, there'd be no more Israel. Right? That's the situation that we're in. And so, where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us in a time where the entire world is, you know, and that's a generalization, but the entire world is largely deceived about this conflict, you know, because they're not getting the whole story. And, you know, I know I'm a history guy and I can say we need to know our history, but we need to know our history. You know, because if you don't know your history, you can be deceived like this. And this idea of this being an apartheid state or occupied territories can be pushed on every major news network in the world. You know, it's not just CNN and MSNBC. It's BBC. It's Al Jazeera. It's anything you can turn on. And that's going to be the narrative. Okay? Now, the comforting side of this is we know who watches over Israel. Right? And I have full confidence in that. And we know before the end that Israel is going to be surrounded by enemy nations that are going to try to destroy them. And I think somebody shows up to save the day. Okay? So we have that to look forward to. But as we, you know, renew our minds and deal with the current events of the day, know that what you hear on TV is largely untrue. Yeah. Well, he's saying this was what would happen. If we go to this event, there will be no more Israel. Yeah, that's the statement. Yeah, he's not supporting it. He's saying this is what would happen if we took those steps. Yeah. All right. So, like I said, if you guys want materials, some of you have asked already, and I'll get those to you. Just shoot me an email or talk to me after. Yeah, Dick, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. If you've ever picked up an airline magazine, in the back of it, it'll tell you which countries you can have passports from and so forth. Mm-hmm. Every one of those states state you cannot enter, but you cannot stay if you have a Jewish or a passport or an Israeli passport or a Jewish person.
Yes. Or, and in many cases, a passport that's been stamped in Israel.
That's been stamped, right.
Yeah. 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 I just read an article on that this week, and I'll close. I know we're running pretty long, but in this whole refugee conversation, which again, there's a lot of elements to this refugee conversation. But you know, there are 19 nations in the world that is exactly the situation that Dick is talking about, that a Jewish person, a person from Israel, cannot travel to. You want to talk about travel bans? There are 19 countries that they cannot enter, or, like I said, if I bring my passport, which has an Israel stamp in it, I will not be allowed into those countries either. Not that I want a vacation in Tehran this year, but, you know, I love how they gave us a reverse travel ban because, you know, so many people wanted to go vacation in Tehran. But, you know, but nobody will talk about that. You'll never hear that, you know, but you'll hear the other way all day long. Hey, when self-preservation and common sense is what's happening. And I'll be up here if anybody wants to ask any questions as well. Like I said, I know I'm trying to cram a whole lot of information in not a whole lot of time. So if you want more information, I can get you that stuff. And the book that is my primary source for all this is by Michael Redelnik, who does great stuff. And it's called The Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. So if you really, you'll see all this if you ever want to read that book. It's a good read. And he brings all the scripture in, the Abrahamic covenant and all that kind of stuff too, that verifies Israel is who Israel says he is. Michael Redelnik, R-Y-D-E-L-N-I-K. And he's a Messianic Jew, so he's got a pretty cool perspective. Yeah, Steve, go ahead.
Dave, so PLO, they occupied Jordan and Lebanon,
yep.
And they came into territory that Israel had.
Yep.
Did Israel allow them to come in?
They have given, I don't know that you would say they allowed the terrorists, but they have given control to the Palestinian Authority, which doesn't keep PLO guys in jail. They let them go and let them go free because they want the terrorism to continue. Yeah, so Israel has...
It was Israel's land.
Yes, and they have given much of that land back. And again, a study of history, World War II, appeasement doesn't work with crazy people. see Adolf Hitler. It doesn't work. Okay? And so this myth is if you just give them back their land, they'll stop attacking. They won't. That's not the goal. Global Islam is the goal. And there's no place for an Israeli state. All right. I've held you too long. Let me close this in prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this time. And I hope it's been a productive study, Lord. I hope it's been something that helps us as believers to see your hand and your sovereignty and your promises and your covenants with Israel. And just the amazing things that we've seen in that land, Lord. And we pray for Israel. We pray for Israel to be saved. We know ultimately that'll happen, but we pray for those Jews that don't know you to know you, Lord, that to believe the gospel, and that would truly transform that society. Just help us to keep our minds sharp, Lord, to renew our minds in this age of misinformation and lies, and to be strong in the truth that you've provided us. And we know you can do that. We thank you for this time together. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Thank you, guys.